Wayne, calling from Palos Verdes, California. Wayne, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. My question this morning is, I'd like to get your view on when the Lord Jesus resurrected, Mary was trying to grab him, and he said, please don't grab me because I haven't gone to the Father yet. What is your view as to why he has to go to the Father before Mary can embrace him?
Well, I think what was going on there is that Mary did not know that he was going to go back to the Father at all. You know, we do, because we can look back at the story. 40 days after his resurrection, Jesus ascended into heaven, and there he remains to this day at the right hand of God. She didn't know that was going to happen. She had known him previous to his death as obviously somebody she loved and was very fond of and very brokenhearted when he died. And now she's seen him alive again. And you can just imagine if somebody, a loved one, a wife or a child of yours or a parent of yours or a friend had died and you were grieving over them, suddenly you saw them alive again and they were back. I mean, you'd be thinking, wow, how wonderful. I thought I wasn't going to see you again, and now you're back. Now we can resume life again together. I think what Jesus is saying to her, the word, the verb he uses in the Greek, it's the word hapto. In the King James Version, it says, don't touch me. But the word touch, hapto, can be translated, don't cling to me. And I think what he's saying is not that she shouldn't be able to touch him at this point. After all, only a few minutes later, he allowed other women to hold on to his feet. They met him and they fell at his feet and grabbed his feet, and he didn't forbid that. I don't think the problem was that he didn't want people to touch him at this point, but rather he's telling her, don't cling to me. In other words, don't think I'm here to stay. I'm going back to my Father. I'm only back for a little while. I'm leaving again, I think is what he's saying. So don't get too emotionally attached to seeing me back here again. That's what I think he means when he says, don't cling to me, because I'm going to my Father. I don't think he means that he cannot physically be touched until he goes to his Father, because many people would touch him between now and the time that he went back. But I think he's preparing her for the fact that although emotionally she's probably already beginning to reattach to him, he's saying, well, you need to be careful about that because you're going to have to see me go again. I'm not here to stay. I'm going back to my Father, which he did 40 days later. So that would be my understanding of his statement to her.
That really makes sense.
All right.
Is this Mary the same Mary throughout the New Testament, like the one for the fragrance oil and the one got the devil?
This is Mary Magdalene. There's lots of people named Mary in the Bible. It's a very common name in those days. In fact, even secular researchers have found from all the secular records of that time that Mary was the most common name in Jewish society in the first century. And so there's lots of people named Mary. Even in the Bible, of course, the mother of Jesus was named Mary. And this Mary is Mary Magdalene. There's a few other Marys, too, including Mary of Bethany and so forth. But we won't worry about them right now. Mary Magdalene is the one that Jesus cast seven demons out of. And we are told that in chapter 8 of Luke. She's not the one who poured ointment on Jesus. That was Mary of Bethany. So that's a different Mary.
Because it seems like these two are the same one.
Mary, we are told in Luke 8 that Mary Magdalene is the one that Jesus cast seven demons out of her. And in John's Gospel in chapter 20, it's Mary Magdalene who came to the tomb. Magdalene refers to the town she was from. And so she was known as Mary of Magdalene. So she's the same Mary in both of those cases. But there are other Marys. There's one Mary who's the sister of Martha and of Lazarus, and she lived in Bethany. So that's a different Mary. And, of course, the mother of Jesus was even a different Mary. That was Mary of Galilee.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your call, Wayne. God bless you. Our next caller is Chris, calling from San Diego, California. Chris, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted you to please shed some light on Solomon for me, King Solomon. And my question is, why is he continually referred to as and regarded as like such a profoundly wise man? When I study some of the actions of his life, I don't find that he seemed very wise. I mean, Proverbs is full of a lot of, you know, nuggets of wisdom and stuff, but I don't know. I mean, his fruit to me just didn't seem very profitable. It seemed kind of...
You know, it's interesting. In Ecclesiastes, Solomon said, as dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to give forth a stinking savor, so a little folly in the life of him that is reputed for wisdom stinks, basically, is what he says. You know, a little thing like a fly, dead fly in the perfume vat can cause the whole perfume to go smell bad, he says. I don't know much about perfuming, but that's what he says happens. He says, so also when a man is reputed to be wise, it's a foul thing when he does something foolish. A little bit of folly can ruin his whole reputation, in other words. Now, Solomon was wise at the beginning. And the wisdom he had often was that he could see the relation of things, the cause and effect relationship of things. And he could see that if you do certain things, these are the results you're going to get. And he spent more time observing that, perhaps, than many people do. He's much more philosophically inclined than many. And he had, I guess he exceeded other philosophers of his day in his observations. But to say that a man can observe and even approve of right behavior is a different thing than saying he's going to do it. And it is definitely unwise to act against your own wise counsel. But I think Solomon became unwise when he made a miscalculation and entered into quite a few marriages to, many of them were to women who were not of the Jewish faith. They were other faiths. And then to please his wives, it says he began to build shrines to their gods and so forth in Jerusalem. And it says his wives turned his heart away from God. Now, he had already said, you know, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And so you don't really have any of the kind of wisdom he was talking about unless you fear God. But clearly, the fear of the Lord diminished in him. I mean, a man who fears God would not build shrines to other gods in Jerusalem. So he had ceased to fear the Lord, as he should, and his wisdom left him, I believe. So we find him doing a number of foolish things after that.
Yeah, I really have a hard time respecting him when he's brought up and trying to apply some level of Christian wisdom to the study of King Solomon.
I've known a number of people who served God in some time of their life, and then they fell away. And the things they said and did when they were serving God are still things of value to me.
Yeah.
I mean, like if I hear an early sermon from somebody who is really strong with the Lord, but I know that since then he's fallen away, if I listen to the sermon, I'll still listen to the sermon as something that came from somebody who really was in touch with God at the time, even though I know in my mind this person didn't live up to it. Actually, there's quite a few songs from the Jesus movement that I like that really ministered to me because the people who wrote them really loved God. Some of those people fell away from the Lord later on, and as far as I know, have not come back to the Lord, which I think was very foolish of them and a great disappointment to me. But when I hear those songs that they wrote when they were close to the Lord, they still minister to me. So, I mean, it's sort of that, like reading the Proverbs or whatever, you know, it ministered to me to read the Proverbs because they were written at a time when Solomon was being wiser and when he was seeing things God's way more.
So if I can concisely understand his life and his folly, he, as you would explain it, in the beginning he had a legitimate wisdom and knowledge and love for God, and he kind of was given into the lust of the flesh or, you know, whatever it was that made him depart from truly holistically serving God and sort of given into those false idols and whatnot. And then in the end, did he finish strong? I mean, in Ecclesiastes, I don't really...
Well, he did. Yeah, he came back. He came back to the Lord in the end of his life. It's not recorded in the history. You know, his story is told in the book of 1 Kings. And basically, the last you hear about him is in chapter 11 of 1 Kings, where he's actually departed from the Lord. So if you only read the historical accounts and nothing more, you wouldn't know that he had ever come back to the Lord. But the book of Ecclesiastes was written by him when he was old. And he, in the book of Ecclesiastes, it's sort of like a prolonged confession. It's sort of like when someone gives their testimony about all the drugs they use and all the things they did wrong before they became a Christian. It's like that. He's talked about his backslidden years and how he sought for peace and he sought for meaning and he sought for fulfillment from things that were under the sun, as he puts it. But that the search for fulfillment in those things was like striving after the wind. It was futile. But at the end of the book, he says he urges young men to serve God all their lives and to give God the youthful years and not just the old years like he was now doing. And he said, what is the conclusion of the matter? This is how he closes the book of Ecclesiastes. He says, what's the conclusion of the matter? Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For he'll bring every work into judgment, whether they be good or evil. So at the end of his life, he certainly was on the right page again, but had apparently a lot of regrets about wasted years and the folly of seeking satisfaction from things other than God.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks. That helps clear things up for me.
Yeah. So when you read Proverbs, you're reading Proverbs from Solomon when he was at his best. And of course, later he drifted. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple peaks and valleys in his life, weren't there?
Yeah, and there have been in mine and other people's too.
Right.
So I mean, I realize that the things that have been said by people when they were close to God are valid things, even if those people didn't hang on to them like they should have.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks, Steve. I appreciate that answer, and that helped definitely give me a little more insight and clarity into my understanding of King Solomon.
All right, Chris. Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Have a good day. God bless you.
You too. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Paul from San Diego. Hey, Paul. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Yeah, it is.
I was looking through Matthew's chapter 5 and 6 and seemed to come to a contradiction, which, of course, is just a contradiction in my understanding. So I was wondering what your take on this was. And that is in 6:1, Matthew 6:1, 1 through 4, Jesus is talking about making sure that you don't let other people see you do your righteous works. Take heed that you do not do your alms before men to be seen of them, otherwise you have no reward of your Father which is in heaven, to the extent that you don't even want to let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. So it seems to be that's told to be very secretive. And at the same time, in previously in Matthew 5:16, Jesus says, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. And I'm also thinking of in John chapter 15, Jesus talks about abiding in him, and then you will bear much fruit to the glory of the Father. And the fruit seems to be that you will do those righteous things that reflect the Holy Spirit in you, working out through you.
Right.
So I'm wondering how you would see those verses.
Sure. Well, the statement, let your light shine before men that they will see your good works, the good works there doesn't refer to religious works. It just refers to good behavior. Your works in the Bible, depending on the context, can refer to specific duties that are performed, like the works of the law, or religious activities, or it can just refer to what emanates from your life. Your works are your behavior. And I think when Jesus said, let men see your good works so that they'll glorify God, I believe he's just saying that let people see that you are well-behaved, you have good behavior, that your behavior is consistent with what you preach, and they'll then glorify God. Now, in chapter 6, where it talks about giving alms and praying and fasting, and it says not to do these things in an ostentatious way, he specifically means don't, like verse 1 says, don't do these charitable deeds to be seen by men. Now, what I think he's making very clear here is, each time he speaks about something like doing, giving charitable, giving a gift or praying or fasting, he says, don't do it like the hypocrites do. He has a very specific thing he has in mind, and that is that the Pharisees did their religious deeds in a very showy way so that people would be impressed with their religiosity. And Jesus is saying, don't be like them. Now, the things he says to do in a non-showy way, there's several things to observe. One of them is they're all religious things, well, kind of religious things, you know, giving to the poor, praying, fasting. These are religious duties that the Jews had. And they're not simply the way you behave all the time, although you may do those things a lot, but those are special religious acts which people did often to be viewed by others as a religious person, to impress them with how good you are. It was an ego trip, and it was not being done to glorify your Father, as Matthew 5:16 says, let your good works be seen so that men will glorify your Father. It was to glorify oneself. And so this is what Jesus is teaching against, is against doing those things that are going to make people think that you're spiritual when maybe you're not so spiritual after all. In other words, it's an ostentatious show of religiosity. But there's another thing about it, too. And, of course, that Jesus is using some hyperbole there when he says, don't let your right hand, your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Well, obviously, that's not a literal thing. Your hands don't know anything anyway. When he talks about praying, he says, go into your closet and shut the door and don't let anyone hear you. Now, we know that that's not a real rule for prayer all the time, because Jesus prayed in front of his disciples. And in the book of Acts, the disciples prayed publicly and things like that. I mean, there's certainly not, it's not a sin to pray publicly. But Jesus is using hyperbole. Basically, he's saying that, you know, if you're going to do something that is virtuous, don't be trying to make it, you know, a public advertisement of your spirituality, like the Pharisees do, like the hypocrites do. He says they have their reward because they're doing it to be seen by men, and that's the reward they're seeking. And they are seen by men, so they have the reward they're seeking. They got the reward they want. But Jesus said you should be doing what you do to seek a reward from God. And when he talks about hiding when you pray or being very secretive in your giving or whatever, I believe that he's not saying that every time you give, every time you pray, it has to be that secretive. But rather, he's trying to emphatically make the point that you shouldn't do these things to be seen. And he sort of exaggerates the degree of secrecy that he's advocating. But it's all about motivation. In Matthew 5:16, it's so that men will glorify your Father. And in chapter 6, it's so that people will think that you are religious and think that you are, you know, better than you are. And so in chapter 6, he's talking about hypocrisy and putting up a false face, whereas in Matthew 5, he's just talking about being real, being good and real. And when people know you, they'll see that you are well-behaved, and they'll say, well, that's a good person, and he's a Christian. So this God makes people good.
Okay. That's very clear now. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I appreciate your call, Paul. God bless you.
Bless you, Steve.
Bye now. Okay. Our next caller is Philip from San Diego. Philip, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. In the Bible, it says Jesus said the Son of Man came eating and drinking. Was he talking about alcoholic beverages?
Yes. Well, I mean, yes. In the context, he was. Because that's Matthew 11. He's making a contrast between himself and John the Baptist. And John the Baptist was a Nazarite who would not drink wine, or for that matter, grape juice, or eat raisins or grapes. That was forbidden to a Nazarite. And he said, John the Baptist came neither eating nor drinking wine, neither eating meat nor drinking wine, and you say he has a demon. And the Son of Man comes eating and drinking, and you say, behold, a wine bibber and a glutton, a friend of sinners. So they were accusing him of being a wine bibber and a glutton, which meant he certainly was eating and drinking. I mean, he was drinking wine. No, if he wasn't drinking wine, He could have just said, no, but that's a false accusation. I haven't drunk any wine. But, of course, why wouldn't he? Everybody drank wine. There was no reason for him not to. They used it at communion. They used it, you know, at all feasts. Wine was used actually to sanitize the water so they could drink it. They'd mix it with water so that they could drink the water safely. And it had to be alcoholic, of course, or else it wouldn't have any benefit in the water.
You know, sometimes people struggle with Jesus drinking alcoholic beverages. Do you think there's a problem with that?
I think there's a problem with the people struggling with it. There's certainly no problem with Jesus drinking it. Like I said, everybody drank it. Alcohol was not strictly something to use for getting drunk. Alcohol was a disinfectant. And every table in the Middle East had wine and water in separate pitchers, and they would mix them together in their glass so that the water would be safe to drink. So, of course, the wine had to be alcoholic, and Jesus drank it just like everybody else. The only person we know of in the first century who didn't, of course, there may have been others that we don't know about, but we know that Timothy had decided to drink only water with no wine in it. And Paul basically corrected him, says, don't drink only water anymore. Add a little wine to it for your stomach's sake and your oft infirmities. And there's Timothy was getting amoebic dysentery because he wasn't doing what everybody else did. He was leaving the wine out of his water. Probably he was trying to keep a Nazirite vow or something like that. So he left the wine out of his diet, and then he got stomach problems. So Paul said, come on, add some wine in there like everybody else. And so hopefully Timothy did, so he could have prolonged his life. But, we have people who have a cultural objection to all alcohol. And some of these people are perhaps people who have trouble with alcohol themselves, or they had family members who had troubles with alcohol. And so it's one of those things where if you've lost a family member or you've had a family ruined because of alcoholism in the family, it's easy to just, you know, pendulum swing and say nobody should ever drink alcohol because I can't handle it, or because my dad couldn't handle it, or my husband couldn't handle it. And so they just say no one can handle it. But that's just not true. Some people can. And so the Bible forbids drunkenness. It says that a drunkard will not inherit the kingdom of God. So obviously a very important thing not to get drunk. But there's nothing in the Bible that says that alcohol is itself to be avoided altogether.
Thank you.
All right. I appreciate your call. If you got a problem with it, don't drink it, though. That's my advice. Okay, we'll talk next to Marie, calling from Tracy, California. Marie, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question is, the Bible tells us that God made us in his own image and likeness. What I'm trying to understand is this. You have a designer, and they make their own taste of design, okay? Now, we know that this designer created this design. What I'm a little bit confused is this. If God made us in his own image and likeness, does it mean that he made us to look like the way he looked? Or is it just the way that he became from his own design and the way he wanted us to look? I don't know if you can understand what I'm trying to say.
I'm a little bit confused. I don't think that we are to necessarily understand that God looks like us. I mean, it may sound like that when it says we're made in his image, but I think it means in his likeness we have spiritual traits that he possesses, which the other animals he created did not have. And so the uniqueness of the human in God's image is not so much that we look more like God than other animals do. After all, there's some animals that look pretty human-like, like some orangutans look like little old men. And, I'm not sure that the way an animal or a person looks is what connects him to the likeness of God. If it were so, then some of us would look more like God than others, because some of us are tall and skinny, and some are short and fat, and there's all kinds of different faces. I don't think that's the significant thing about being in God's image. I think what it is that God had made all the animals and had not given them certain traits that he wanted to give to a species that he himself possesses, so that they'd be like children rather than like pets. And that would be rational thought. That would be a spiritual essence. That would be a creative drive. That would be you know, these I guess the mental powers and spiritual powers that make a human being different than an animal. Our DNA is very similar to that of the chimpanzees, but our spirit and our intellectual life are worlds apart from chimpanzees. And that's, I think, the way in which man is different than the other animals in the image of God. It's more like in spiritual and intellectual qualities.
I'm not trying to say that that we are related to the animals or anything. What I was trying to understand is that the Bible tells us he made us in his own image. So in other words, I'm his likeness. So in other words, he invented the image that he wanted us to look like. Is that what the scripture is telling us?
Well, that's not what those words mean. I understand what you're saying. You're saying, does this mean that his own image means an image that he himself selected for us, or does it mean something more than that? I think it's basically saying that he did make us to resemble him in some features. That's what his likeness is. I mean, James said that we are inconsistent when we bless God, and then we curse men who are made in the similitude of God. This is in James 3:9. So it says that men are made in the similitude of God. That means they're made to be similar to God in some ways. Of course, we are not similar to God in all ways.
So in other words, it means spiritually speaking.
I think so, yes.
All right, then. Thank you very much. God bless you.
Okay, Marie. Thank you for calling. God bless you, too. Well, there's the music, which means we don't have time for another call. I'm sorry, because we have other callers waiting. However, we do have tomorrow, if the Lord tarries. And The Narrow Path is a daily program, Monday through Friday. We're on from 9:30 to 10 each weekday. And you can call in with questions or just listen in if that's helpful to you. You can also go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thenarrowpath.com. There are hundreds of MP3 files there you can listen to for free, or take them, download them onto your iPod. There are past radio programs going back a year, or actually several years. And so there's plenty of resources, and nothing is for sale. It's all free. It's at thenarrowpath.com. We are listener-supported. You might want to help us out. You can go to the website and check on that. Thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of KBRT, its ownership, its management, or its sponsors.
Merry Christmas to you. It is Christmas Day. I hope that you are having a blessed time with friends and family. If you're listening to me, maybe you're running a little late, or you're doing what I usually have to do, and that's make rounds with family. Okay, from morning till about 11 o'clock, we're going to be at Grandma's. Then we're going to travel over to your mother's house, and we're going to hang out there. Don't eat too much, because then we've got to go to Aunt Carol's house or so-and-so's to have that dessert that everybody loves. And exchange gifts in all those places. You know the type of routine I'm talking about. Just have fun today. Drive safe. And thanks for listening to KBRT while you're doing so. We will be here throughout the day. I wish we were playing Christmas music, but not right now. We have some of those, where does it come from type topics. But anyway, thanks so much for listening to KBRT. Stay right here. Make sure you visit our website, kbrtradio.com. It's brand new, and it is our communication tool to you. You can learn all about this station and the ministries you get to hear on air. But above everything else, Merry Christmas to you. I'm Rob Newton.
Here's another free event from the KBRT Community Bulletin Board. Begin the new year with praise and worship. Rhema Church in Carson welcomes both believers and non-believers to attend the Alternative New Year's Celebration. It'll be held Thursday, December 31st from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m., and anyone is welcome. For information and direction to Rhema Church in Carson, visit therhemahouse.org. Rhema is spelled R-H-E-M-A, therhemahouse.org. Tell us about your free event by sending complete details to events at CrawfordBroadcasting.com.
L.A. County's Christian Voice, KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa, and KNSN San Diego. Also on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled Change Your Words, Change Your Life. Words. You use them every day, and they might feel trivial and simple in your daily conversations, but have you ever thought how you really use words? When you speak, are those words positive and encouraging for yourself and others, or are they hurtful and negative? The Bible describes how the tongue may be a small part of the body, but it can do great things in life. It's up to you, though, whether those things are good or bad. In today's teaching, Joyce will share just how powerful words can be and how if you learn to choose your words wisely and speak what God wants you to speak, then it can set you up for a much brighter future. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, Change Your Words, Change Your Life.
We should have a goal to be the most thankful person on the face of the earth. Start every day with thanksgiving and go through each day thanking God for little things like hot water and a friend and every convenience that you have, and thank God for your salvation. Thank God for what you know. Thank God and keep thanking Him. It's a place of power. Thanksgiving is a place of power. Philippians 2:14. Do all things without grumbling and fault finding and complaining. How many things? All things. That means drive to work in traffic. That means do your dishes, clean your house, pay your bills, do all things, and do it for the glory of God. Just do it as an exercise for the glory of God.